You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, and I am so sorry to all of you who don't treat the first Monday in May as a national holiday. The day we all judge the best and worst in fashion from the comfort of our beds. I'm talking, of course, about the Met Gala, whose theme this year was Karl Lagerfeld, the late controversial fashion designer who led the House of Chanel for years. If you've somehow escaped the Getty Image red carpet photos of Rihanna or Doja Cat or Jared Leto, honestly, kudos to you. The Met looks are inescapable. And my next guest, Marjan Carlos, a fashion journalist and former Vogue writer, stayed up way too late at a Met Gala after party, getting the tea for me.
It was fun. It was really, really fun. I was like, I cannot be this lit on a Monday. But all the girls were there. They were.
Ooh, when you say the girls, like, we got to give the people specificity.
I saw Kendall Jenner. I saw Kylie. I saw Bad Bunny. I saw SZA. I don't know if Rihanna was there because I did leave at 2 a.m. So I don't know if she came after I left or she went to another party. But it was packed.
So let's get into it, because we didn't have you out here leaving a party early and possibly missing Rihanna to not get to what we need to get to. What are your most memorable moments from the Met Gala?
You know, I believe that Anne Hathaway and Rihanna were like the winners of last night. And people can fight me, you know. I felt like they stole the show. I felt like they imbued the essence of Chanel and Karl Lagerfeld. And they also had, they sold it to us. Those two really stood out as the winners. But there were also a lot of other incredible moments. Doja Cat.
Yes. Doja Cat had full feline cat face like prosthetics while wearing this beautiful, like sparkle encrusted white floor-length gown that also had a matching headpiece that kind of had little cat ears that reminded me of the Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman cat sort of headpiece.
Yes.
It was like a beautiful, sparkling helmet that just perfectly framed this cat face. To me, that was like an obvious call out to Karl Lagerfeld's beloved cat, Choupette.
It was, and I love the way that you described it. I definitely feel like it was like this Catwoman helmet, and you know, I liked that. I liked that there was camp on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so serious, because a lot of people, I feel like, they're so concentrated on being tasteful that they don't have fun. And
yes.
I appreciated the camp of it all.
I think when I think about my favorite looks, like I loved Anne Hathaway's dress. She wore this beautiful Versace gown that also recalled a lot of elements of the House of Chanel, also recalled a lot of the ways that Karl Lagerfeld would remix a lot of the house elements of Chanel, such as the chains and the camellia flowers and all of the white. But it had a very like 90s and tweed, of course.
Yes.
And it had a very early to mid 90s Versace cutout kind of like laced up, exposing skin kind of moment. Also, I think a lot of people saw Cardi B's outfit.
Yes.
This huge, voluminous, like it was like very shiny, lots of black camellias. She had like this sort of gray, this big grayish white wig that kind of recalled Carl's like sort of like powdered white ponytail. I felt like a lot of the best looks of the night, even from the men as well, like Harvey Guillen and Taika Waititi, Brian Tyree Henry, Bad Bunny, also kind of went for it with the fun, the daring, the sort of more cartoony elements of interpreting a lot of Karl Lagerfeld's work.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still felt like a lot of people played it safe, but I feel like the people that really went for it, I feel like it most frequently paid off last night, and I was really into that.
I think so, too. I mean, Karl Lagerfeld had a lot of signifiers, so it gave a lot of people room to play, and I think the men were probably very excited about that opportunity, right? I mean, normally they come in black tuxes and they go home.
Yes.
I mean, I saw Alton Mason did a moment with lace boots, and
and a full white lacy outfit, like he embodied the bride. Like at the yes. end of a couture show, there's typically always some sort of white outfit that's changed over the years. It used to traditionally be a white wedding gown thought of as like the bride look. And yes. Alton Mason, who is an incredibly statuesque and graceful model, he was like the perfect mannequin for this Absolutely. White lace head-to-toe bridal look. It was incredible.
It looked like it was a jumpsuit, and there was like a corsetry and then these beautiful boots, and it was a fantasy.
I agree with Marjan. There are winners and losers at the Met Gala, and I'm declaring the night's winners as Doja Cat, Teyana Taylor, and Cardi B. Jared Leto, I'm sorry, but if you're listening, you lost. I dare you to at me. Coming up, we're getting deeper into this year's theme for the Met Gala, Karl Lagerfeld, and his complicated legacy. And playing a special Met Gala game I'm calling Show Me the Receipts. We'll be right back. So the whole theme of the Met Gala this year was about Karl Lagerfeld. An interesting selection for the theme. Mm-hmm. But before we get into, you know, a lot of the breathtaking design, as well as the not so cute elements of Karl's legacy. First, what do you think of him?
I mean, when I was looking at the archival imagery of him from like those early 90s fashion shoots that he was doing for American Vogue, he really created such an aesthetic. And I mean, in a lot of ways, he was like a young savant in the design world, because he came up very young and he did a lot very quickly. There's also, he always had a fan. He had signifiers. I think he understood, like, if you're a fashion person, there's like your tells, right? Or uniform that you wear, kind of like armor in a way. And he created his own world. I think that's what a lot of fashion people do. They create their own worlds. They live in it. And that's how they kind of survive.
Yeah, very effectively. I mean, I think about another one of my favorite looks from last night. Teyana Taylor's look in Tom Brown was phenomenal. I think what made her look work so well is not only did it suit her perfectly,
yes,
but it also featured so much Karl Lagerfeld iconography. Yeah. I think of Karl Lagerfeld as somebody who had so many different points of iconography, because you could see a silhouette just referencing him and immediately know who
yes.
it is. The little ponytail, which Teyana Taylor had the perfect little kind of like tiny little like porridge, little hang time ponytail in the back. She had the sunglasses, which he always was mm-hmm. wearing.
If you're going to be a legendary designer, I think that you need to have some visual marking and signatures like that, that people can recognize a mile away. That's what makes mm-hmm. you last.
I mean, he also had that not just for himself, though. He also had those visual signifiers for his clothing. I wonder, is there any style, because, you know, we got to give people something to visualize. Is there any style that people might be wearing now that we can credit to Karl Lagerfeld?
We have to give it up to the pearls. Men are wearing pearls with a vengeance now. And I think that is such a signature Karl move.
Pearls are associated with like Coco Chanel, who started the House of Chanel, also somebody with a very not so cute legacy, despite how people think about the clothes. Her Nazi past is something that's been discussed more in recent years. But the pearls that are so often associated with Chanel originally sort of come from her as like a favorite. And they are, it's a part of sort of like the house code that Karl Lagerfeld and any Chanel designer had to follow as being like the creative director of that brand. But I 100% agree with you. His interpretation of that house code mm-hmm. created this different visual lexicon for how people incorporate pearls into an outfit that is something that feels particular to Karl Lagerfeld himself, as opposed to something that is only a Chanel type of thing.
Yes.
You know, we've been gesturing at this thus far in our conversation, but to really jump into it, Karl Lagerfeld is also a figure very worthy of critique.
Yeah.
He had some very controversial thoughts. He shared, you know, his thoughts about fatphobia, yes. saying that nobody wants to see curvy women. Yes. Homophobia at times racism. He's made disparaging remarks about the Me Too movement and also against immigrants, even, you know, in his later years, as I'm talking like as recently as possibly 2017, you know, misogynistic remarks. I mean, in some ways, he was a very hyperbolic speaker. And like, even, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that I don't chuckle from time to time when I read some of his remarks about disliking children and short men.
They're like, same.
Implying that short men like feel bad about being short, and so they kind of want to take it out on everybody. I think he said actually like they hate it about themselves and they want to kill you. Like, that is hyperbole. But also, I mean, there's a lot of really messed up things that he's said over the years. I can appreciate his craft, but I feel like you also have to look at the uglier parts of his legacy as well.
Absolutely. And I definitely remember his fat phobia being a major point of concern at one point. And he himself battled weight. I think his opinions around fat phobia, around who should be represented on the runways, it's outdated. And so many people in the fashion industry think like that. And I think it's unfortunately reflective of a very, very ugly side of the industry, you know?
Yes, 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 yes. I felt like there was not a lot of critique of Carl. I mean, I'll say this. I watched the Vogue red carpet coverage.
Right.
Which is, you know, live streamed on YouTube. And so I can't say that I necessarily expected that. I was disappointed to see this really distinguished publication, Vogue, not want to embrace all of the legacy and to be able to kind of look at it with fresh eyes. That was something that felt kind of surprising to me, is fashion and history are both topics that invite and require a lot of conversation, simulating conversation. And I felt like having Karl Lagerfeld as the theme was a good opportunity to do that. But I just didn't see that being engaged in the online video broadcast commentary that I saw. But I wonder, did you see any sort of critique around? And if you did or did not, what did you think about that?
I didn't see as much critique. I agree with you. It was more like an homage. Mm-hmm. I will say that, you know, Vogue has an interesting approach to critique. I don't think that they're in the business of critique. If they don't like something, they don't talk about it. So I was not surprised that there was no like, oh, well, we should have this critical conversation around his body dysmorphia and his views on on women's bodies and weight and racism and homophobia. I'm not surprised by that.
We noticed when we were preparing for this conversation that Monday morning, Anna Wintour was on CBS Morning News, and she said, you know, obviously Carl was a complicated man. And I think Andrew's decision, meaning Andrew Bolton, who's curating this exhibition, Andrew's decision was really to focus on the work. And it's not a biography. There are documentaries and books that cover all sides of Carl's life. We are really focusing on his work, she said. But, you know, to your point, all of these other aspects of Carl's life and his worldview informed how the work was produced.
Yes.
And what the work was meant to celebrate and highlight. And I feel like you kind of can't pull those things apart. That's my opinion.
I feel like it's business as usual at that publication.
Business as usual. I wonder what is being said to us in him being honored in that way. What is being said to us as consumers or even just like a fashion appreciating audience?
I guess it's asking the viewer to compartmentalize, right? Like, you have to like put this person over here for now and put your feelings aside and just look at the body of work. That's very exhausting, especially for critical minds who are like, hey, this is really beautiful, but I also would like to talk about how he engaged with the world. Because his worldview is obviously put into the collections. And if I'm at odds with that at times, it makes me feel awkward when I'm engaging with the work, even honoring the work by going to see it at the exhibit. I know that at that publication, there's also a very strong ethos of like, where is the fashion? And I think It's asked of you all the time of like, as writers or editors, like, where is the fashion?
Because you were a senior writer at Vogue.
Yes. I worked there and, you know, was constantly asked of like, where is the fashion? And I really had to balance between being political and just looking at clothes objectively, right? Mm-hmm. And taking my identity out of it. I've never really been able to do that. I mean, I can in like a very concrete way be like, that is a pleated skirt, you know, like I can look at fashion in that way. But I also am just like, this is like really interesting that this collection is coming about it during this time. And we're seeing this trend in the industry. I definitely question constantly how the work is being made and under what context. But I think that an ethos at that publication is just like, where is a fashion? And they try to sweep everything else underneath the rug, so to speak.
I mean, but also too, I mean, it's also a publication that like, when I think about like how different, say like, you know, I think about like Robin Givhan at Washington Post, or even Rachel Tashtian, who's also now at the Washington Post, or someone like a Terry Agins, who was, I believe, at the Wall Street Journal for a long time. When you think about those sorts of fashion journalists, Washington Post is not dependent. Wall Street Journal is not dependent on getting advertising dollars from the same brands that they're critiquing. I think about Kathy Horan, you know, who was
the
fashion editor at the New York Times for a long time. She could kind of, she got disinvited from
yes, Marc Jacobs. Yes, she did. They were like, we don't want you there.
She bemoaned and remarked upon the fact that his show started very late. And so she had her invitation revoked after that. It seems like those editors and writers might also have like, there's a different editorial tack from a newspaper as opposed to like a fashion publication that also has this complicated relationship with brands and that they need that advertising money to continue forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say American Vogue is very commercial in that respect, and it acts as a retailer. And to have very outspoken or progressive views may affect those relationships.
Coming up, Marjan and I are playing a special game in honor of fashion's biggest night that I'm calling Show Me the Receipts. We'll be right back. Okay, so today, in honor of the Met Gala, we are going to test Marjan's knowledge on price tags in a game that we are calling Show Me the Receipts.
I want to see the receipts.
I'm a toxic shopper, so I might be really good at this.
All right. So this game is loosely based on one of the games from The Price is Right.
Love.
And how it works is I'm going to present you with two things that you could buy, and you have to guess which one is more expensive.
Okay.
One of the examples will be Met Gala themed, and the other will be an extravagant thing that our producer, Corey Antonio, found. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All righty, let's go. Okay. First up, the cost of a ticket to the Met Gala this year, 2023, or the cost of a new 2023 Cadillac sedan?
Oh, the ticket to the Met Gala is more expensive.
Ding, ding, ding. You were right. I don't know if like buying Cadillacs is a part of your toxic shopping habits, but yes, the cost of a Met Gala ticket is reportedly $50,000. And the cost of a Cadillac sedan 2023 retails at what now feels like a steal, $39,295. The ticket is more expensive.
Yes. That's crazy. And the tables they're out of control.
Ooh, woo, woo, woo.
That's why a lot of people have to be sponsored. I mean, it's a whole thing. I mean, these brands get together and they buy these tables that are hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So next up, the cost of one night in the Carlisle Hotel, the hotel where many celebrities used to get ready. It is a famous 5-star hotel in New York City. I myself personally have never stayed there, but I'm open to it. Or dinner for two at one of San Francisco's fanciest restaurants, Atelier Crène, named for Dominique Crène. For context, it has a Michelin star, and there was an episode of Chef's Table made about the place / chef.
A night stay at the Carlisle probably starts around $8 to $900. And then dinner for two probably would be like $500, not including alcohol. So I'm going to go with the dinner.
This one you didn't get.
Oh,
we found rooms starting from $1,300, which seems to be the standard.
Yeah.
To the premier suite for $9,000, whereas a fixed tasting menu at Atelier Crin is $475 a person. So the hotel is technically more, but I'd say they're pretty close.
It's around there, right? Like that's kind of where the five-star hotel starts. I'm not acting like I can afford this. I just know these things because I'm a toxic shopper. Like I'm like, I'd like love to go there.
You like those people on The Price is Right who like know the price of Tropicana orange juice down to the cent because you're like, I'm in the grocery store all the time.
I'm literally online constantly looking for things. Constantly. So this is very interesting.
Okay, one last question in our little game. Is it more expensive to buy a table at the Met Gala or is it more expensive to charter a private jet to Nairobi and back home to New York?
I'm going to go with the table because it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't know the price ticket on a private jet, but I'm going to go with the Met dinner.
I have to say, so these prices are pretty close, but you are absolutely right. The cost of a table at the Met Gala is reported to be somewhere between $275,000 and $300,000. And the cost of a private jet charter to and from Nairobi, because of course, you know, I'm saying we want to go on vacation, but also it's good to come home as well. It is quoted around $226,380. The table at the Met Gala is more expensive, although... Wow. I'm like, would I love a private jet charter to Nairobi? Absolutely.
I would.
I prefer it.
I just to say that I did.
Yeah.
To have my like moment. And then I'd be like, okay, this is horrible for the environment. Horrible.
Our producer, Corey Antonio, commented, he's messaging right now. You absolutely ate that. You absolutely murdered this game. You would be an assassin on Price is Right.
This is not one of the best traits that I have, but it is a trait that I have where I'm just always shopping and I'm constantly thinking about price.
Oh, well, Marjan, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about all things Met Gala. This conversation has fed my soul and scratched my I need to talk about the Met Gala itch. So thank you so much.
It was a whirlwind night. This was a fantastic way to do it. And I just appreciate having the opportunity.
That was fashion journalist and editor Marjan Carlos. This episode was produced by Corey Antonio Rose and Barton Girdwood. Our editor was Jessica Plachik. I'm Brittany Luce, and we'll be back on Friday for another episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. Talk soon, y'all.